Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner as we begin our look at Selma, Alabama, and the 50th anniversary of that march across the Pettus Bridge. We're having a conversation here to start with Cornell William Brooks, of course, the new president and CEO of the NAACP. And Cornell William Brooks, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. It's a delight to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages, but do call if you can, 410-319-8888. So are you in Selma now?
I am in Selma as we speak.
So, I'm going to begin this way. I think that there's so much to talk about here in terms of where we are in this time since Selma, which we'll talk about a great deal in this hour. But I'm curious what you think the significance of this walk will be with all of you now.
Well, it is significant in that we are inspired by the past and yet inspired by the past to act in the present. So en route to Selma, on the plane, I met people who had walked 50 years ago across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Last night in a service, we commemorated the martyrs of the movement and invoked the names of James Reeb, Reverend Reeb, and Jimmy Lee Jackson, and Viola Luizzo. And invoking those names, one can't help but think about the sacrifices they made and ask yourself this question. If they did all that they did with what little they had and a maximum sacrifice, why can't we do more with what we have been given? And so 50 years later, to have the Voting Rights Act under an unprecedented assault, and for Congress to deliberate over giving medals to those who marched 50 years ago while refusing a committee vote on protecting the right to vote is at minimum historically ironic and more precisely tragic. So we're very much inspired by being here, but so much so that I really want to speak to what's happening now.
And talking about what's happening now, you know, some of the people, you know, that'll be on this platform, who'll be there today, who'll be at these celebrations, celebrating this the march across that bridge, 50 years ago, are people who oppose, like the senator from Alabama, who oppose the voting rights law, oppose allowing it to come into Congress and the Senate. I mean, sometimes, I guess for me, when I see that, those contradictions are glaring. It's important to celebrate this. It's important that people walk across this bridge. It's important that John Lewis and Congressman Sarbanes and many others are walking across this bridge today and that you're there, because we have to remember that but think about what the future brings. But there are also those contradictions of all those kind of sitting there smiling and celebrating, who are just those who want to keep the voting rights bill gutted and not brought back.
Well, we need to be clear about this. Standing on the sacrifice of others while not honoring their ideals is a desecration of their memory. Nothing more, and certainly nothing less than that, and perhaps more than that. And we are very much moved, inspired by the events of this weekend and the stories that will be told and the legacy that will be passed on to our children and grandchildren. But we need to be clear here. We're not going to allow this to be turned into a photo op. And so as a consequence, the NAACP has announced what we are calling America's Journey for Justice, which is a series of events and series of demonstrations and direct actions from Selma to Washington, D.C., 850 miles, where we're going to push relentlessly over the course of weeks and months the full restoration of the Voting Rights Act under the banner of Our Lives, Our Votes, Our Jobs, and Our Schools Matter. We're mobilizing a multiracial, multi-ethnic coalition of labor, environmental organizations, civil rights organizations, the money and politics organizations, and labor, and of course, most importantly and prominently, young people. And so we're going to turn that route from Selma to Washington into holy and sacred ground in terms of contemporary commitment, present-day sacrifice. And so we need to be clear here. Selma is less a matter of commemoration of things past than it is a recommitment ceremony for things present. And so if people think that they can come here and commemorate, take a few pictures, post them on social media, and wash their hands of voting a la Pontius Pilate, that's simply not going to happen. And the NAACP is going to be in the forefront with our coalition partners. This is a growing coalition, emerging coalition. But, America's Journey for Justice is very much about ensuring that we don't honor history with empty words while desecrating that history and those martyrs by our inability or our unwillingness to act in the present. It's simply not going to happen.
So tell me a bit more about this before you have to you go, Cornel William Brooks. Tell us about a bit more of this march. It's starting when and how is it going to happen?
Well, we're looking to launch this. Really, it's a series of direct actions. We are not going to disclose the whole of them, but let's put it this way. It literally represents a trail from Selma to Washington. It's 850 miles.
Yes.
We anticipate civil disobedience. We're going through the five states that are really left particularly vulnerable under the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. So we're going from Alabama to Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and into the District of Columbia. Along that route, there are textile towns, big cities, their teachers and police officers and college students, and we expect to hold direct actions in places where we want to encourage our elected officials to give this issue due attention and due action. Now, this is a sustained campaign. This is not a matter of one event, and this is certainly not a matter of one news story. But really, this is a big tent conversation with the whole of the country around voting. And our effort here is to do over the course of many weeks what was done over the course of roughly a few weeks in terms of the Selma to Montgomery March of 50 miles. We're trying to do this over the course of many weeks and the course of 850 miles. So this is a matter of history making as a consequence of being inspired by history and the vote. So, we are encouraging people to join us. It's going to be the kind of thing that we believe will capture the attention of the country. Now, this is going to require a great deal of sacrifice. We need to be clear about this because this is not something that's going to be done in a day, but it's going to take place over the course of weeks and months. So there'll be more to discuss, more information, but we wanted to come to Selma and lay down a mark that we're going to do this and that we're not going to allow this really sacred occasion to be reduced to a political photo op. And I believe the overwhelming majority of people here don't want that, and they get that. And if you could have, I tell you, Mark, if you could have been in the memorial service last evening and seeing people of every hue and every heritage, grade schoolers and high schoolers who were born decades after Bloody Sunday, literally drawing from the wellspring of history, and not only seeing it as a matter of what their grandparents did, but seeing this as a matter of something that they can do now. It was just extraordinarily powerful, and we're gonna tap the full wellspring of that over the course of weeks and months.
Well, I wish I could have been there, but what we will do, and we'll stay in touch with your office, Cornel William Brooks, is to when this march takes place, is to cover it as intensely as possible and hopefully be able to walk with you on part of those ways to the South.
Thank you so much.
I mean that. So we will be in touch, and I think this is very important, and I appreciate you taking time out of your morning here to join us. Cornell William Brooks is the president and CEO of the NAACP. Thank you so much, and thanks for this march, and we will be covering it, and I hope to join you on part of that walk.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Mark.
Take care. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. As we go to break here, you're hearing Wes Montgomery around midnight. The great Wes Montgomery, born on this day in 1923. And we'll be right back in 2 seconds. Don't go away. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. On our way to continue our conversation on the importance of Selma, we just got an announcement here that Morgan State University will be closed today. And essential personnel are to report, but Morgan State University is closed today. And to continue our discussion, we are joined by a really wonderful panel. Dr. Barbara Harris-Combs is with us. She's Assistant Professor of Sociology and Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi. Pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Harris-Combs.
Thank you so much.
And Andrew Iden is with us. Andrew Iden is co-author, along with Congressman John Lewis and illustrator Nate Powell, of the graphic memoir trilogy, March, the second volume of which was just published, and he's digital director and policy advisor to Congressman John Lewis. And Andrew, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Adar Ayura joins us once again, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. And Adar, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you so much.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can send us emails at talk@steinershow.org. And you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. But join us if you can, 410-319-8888, and talk about what Selma means now for us all. And I think that more than any time, because of this anniversary and because of the film that came out, it's in people's consciousness in ways, Dr. Barbara Harris-Combs, it has not been before.
Yes.
But, you know, and I think that there's still sometimes a disconnect. I said a little while ago to Cornell William Brooks, president of NAACP, that here you have this celebration taking place in Selma, and you have the senator from Alabama sitting up there on the dais, and looks like he may be speaking. And in the halls of Congress, he's one of those who does not want to allow a new vote to take place on a new voting rights bill.
Sure.
Contradictions.
Certainly. As a sociologist, though, I know that life is full of those contradictions.
Yes.
That people are complex and contradictory, but I do appreciate opportunities like this. I think most of us don't recognize those contradictions that are inherent in the things that we do and say, and I think it's important to point that out.
But I wonder, just as you look at this, as both of his, what that means for the studies and the things you've written in your book, Selma to Montgomery, The Long March to Freedom, and how that does relate to young people today, other than just a historical event, because you make history so disconnected from reality in this country.
Yes. I'm sorry, the question is, again, what?
I want to know just how, I mean, to make this connection, I mean, because we often disconnect. You know, we look at things that happen in a moment in time.
Yes.
That came before us, but we often don't make that bridge of key understanding between what that means now, then, for where we are now.
Exactly. And one of the things that I like to do is to illuminate for people the continuity between history and our own personal biographies now. And so I think certainly things like the recent report that just came out about Ferguson and the whole movement about Black Lives Matter provide an opportunity for us to help young people to make those connections, that this is a modern-day form of lynching, a pattern that has historically existed for some time. And we like to think that because of advances, and please don't get me wrong, there have been advances, but we like to think that because of advances, that means that these battles of the past have already been fought and won, when the truth is that battles are just that, a series of progresses, retreats, and I think it's important if we're are going to help young people to make those connections, we have to perhaps start with their current lives today and help them to see that connection to the past.
Andrew, I'd like you to jump in on that because I know that you in some ways bridge this divide yourself, given the fact that you're so deeply involved in the digital world, but also working as a policy advisor to Congressman Lewis and helping produce this incredible series of graphic books around this issue.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. We have not taught this generation about their history, and then we are surprised when they don't see the context in which these actions are taking place. As you said, I serve as digital director to the congressman, so I handle a lot of social media, and these are tools in which this young generation is capable of organizing on a larger scale than any generation before it. And I think we're just starting to realize that potential. What we've done with these graphic novels, with Congressman Lewis touring around the country, speaking to students, is we're trying to show them the model of the Nashville student movement, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and how it was successful so that they are able to have something to base their own actions on, their own progressive movements and direct action. And what we've seen as we've gone to places like Ohio State, Michigan State, Louisiana State University, is that with that model, they're able to create their own organizations. I'll point out one in particular in Baton Rouge. It's called Baton Rouge Organizing, and we went there, and the student government gave out copies of March, and these students attended our lecture, and we talked specifically about how the principles of nonviolence can be applied to social media today. And since that event, they've created this organization and engaged in a sustained campaign of direct action. They've been covered all over the country, including in USA Today. And I think you're just starting to see the beginning of this. This generation is hungry. They want to know more. But we, as the generation before them, have failed to educate them properly. And so what we have to do is both show them how it was done once before and then enable and empower them to do it again.
We have to take a very short break. We'll come right back with our three guests here. And we want you to join us at 410-319-8888. And appropriately going into this very quick break, we are hearing Alabama by John Coltrane. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more to be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, as we look at Selma and its legacy. And of course, that's Baby Love by the Supremes. Mary Wilson, the Supremes, born on this day in 1944. Happy birthday, Mary Wilson. And we are here with Dr. Barbara Harris Combs. Dr. Combs is Assistant Professor of Sociology and Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi, author of From Selma to Montgomery, The Long March to Freedom, Andrew Iden, who is co-author along with Congressman Lewis, and illustrator Nate Powell, the graphic memoir trilogy, March, the second volume, which was just published, and his digital director and policy advisor to Representative John Lewis, and Adara Ayira, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. And Adara, I'm glad you're with us as well. And I wanted to kind of probe where we are now. I mean, the march was incredibly important in its day, and so much happened around the march, from the horrific murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson that kind of set things off in many ways, the murders of others that took place in that space. It was a moment when so many people, black, white, and more, walked together across that bridge. But I want to kind of focus on the spirit of Selma, as I was trying to do with Cornell William Brooks, as I did with Cornell William Brooks, about where that takes us now and what that moment says to us about the power of people. I think people don't really realize sometimes, who weren't alive then or didn't walk through it then, about what it meant to face the terror, the abject terror, the legal terror that black folks lived under in the South. And I think in that context, we have to think about where that was then, but also where we are right now. Adar?
Well, we focus on Selma, and I really appreciate what your guests have said about basically past being present, because that terror is still felt in so many communities across the nation where people have to engage with police in a way that does not respect their civil rights in the ways in which we see the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act being gutted. So that terror, that support of institutional state, federal laws, policies, culture that supports and maintains that terror, Mark, people are living with that right now.
You know, I'm curious in the conversations you have, and Andrew Iden, you said this earlier, I'm going to go to Dr. Combs and right over to you, about where young people are when they think of Selma, of where it was then, what that meant, since it's in the consciousness because of the movie now, consciousness because of the movie and more now. I think the movie's had a huge effect on people thinking about this. But how this relates to where they are today. And I just think about that because people don't realize that, you know, when you're looking at this history, that so many of the people on that bridge, Barbara Harris Combs, were young, were eight, yes. teenagers, people yes. in their early 20s.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a reason that they were young, and that is the terror that you've been talking about, and the fear and the very real concern about people losing their jobs. And so this was one of those moments in history where it was largely a young people's movement. Frederick Reese in Selma was a school teacher at the time, and there's discussion about how teachers and parents approved the children going out and marching, and the teacher might be writing something on the board and knew that it was time for the march, and the teacher would turn his or her back, and then the students would all leave. But it is absolutely true that young people have so much power, but I also don't want us to lose sight of the reason that the movement relied largely on young people, and I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that part of the reason that our young people have a naivete today about how awful the past was and how similar the past is to the present is because of a couple of reasons. One of those is our parents failed to share with us those stories of the past, but they did it for a reason, because there's a racial battle fatigue that you face, and you just kind of shove stuff down rather than to talk about it. And those stories weren't in our history books either. And so there are a lot of factors that contribute to that. But absolutely, young people today have that same potential when they can be mobilized and reach that kind of level of both outrage and, you know, I've got nothing else to lose.
Andrew, and I think that what Dr. Barbara Harris Combs just said is so important. And I think about this graphic novel, and I really think what you've done here with the congressman and Nate Powell is really important, because, I mean, this is in many ways how information gets through.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, there was a comic book that was used after the Montgomery bus boycott to help inspire some of the earliest acts of civil disobedience.
Right, right.
I don't think the civil rights movement would have been nearly as successful without the young people. I mean, there was a moment...
There would have been no civil rights movement without the young people.
Absolutely. and I think as we look at young people today, we have to realize that we have actually shackled them far more than they were during the civil rights movement because of student loans. With this generation to graduate from college with $10, $20, $50, $100,000 in student loan debt, it has put them in a position where they can no longer be the activists that led the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I mean, John Lewis was 25 years old when he marched on Bloody Sunday. If he had graduated from Fisk, if he had graduated from American Baptist College with this sort of debt that students are graduating with today, he never would have been able to take that $10 a week job as chairman of SNCC. And I think as we look at young people today, we have to realize that we've put this, essentially, we've put them in a form of indentured servitude. And so they're forced to go join the corporate meritocracy or to sign up for jobs that they may only take because they have to pay that debt rather than be the activists that they really want to be. And as long as we have shackled young people like that, we'll never be able to realize the full potential of their activism. And I think that's going to end up being one of those first critical battles, much like the Montgomery bus boycott was in its time, before we can get ultimately to a place where we have our Selma moment that truly liberates a generation.
You know, I was thinking about young people. Just a quick aside here. This morning on Democracy Now!, which the station broadcasts, there was a man speaking in a very emotional ways who was 7 years old and walking in that march, 7 years old, and his job was to keep people on the side. And it turned out he was the cousin of Robert Shahid, who is our morning host.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so it was young people. I mean, it was young people. The president of the UMBC here in Baltimore, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, is Freeman Hrabowski, who was one of the children who was arrested in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So this stuff is really critical for us to understand, I think,
yes,
about who that army was.
Yes.
Right. Well, and you can look at Birmingham as well. I mean, that shocked the conscience in 1963 to see these children in Kelly Ingram Park having fire hoses turned on them, having dogs used against them. And it was a major turning point. It forced President Kennedy to address the nation. And so for young people today to be able to participate in that way, we can use social media. We can use, I mean, look at how these videos of police brutality are spreading across the Internet in new ways. There is a direct correlation.
So, I mean, and Adar, let me bring you back in. I mean, so, you know, I think that this is important. You see that in Baltimore, too, and wherever you go in this country. You can see it, as Andrew was saying, with the Baton Rouge organizing. You can see it, what happened in Louisiana. You can see with young people, the Dream Keepers in Florida. You can see it with the young people here in Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle that stopped that youth jail from being built, at least temporarily. I mean, so it's not as if young people are not there, but I really think it's important to make these connections.
And Mark, there are a couple of things that are in play today as they have always been in play. We talk about shackling young people, and I think that that is true. There is an organizer in Ferguson who made a statement, this is not your granddaddy's civil rights movement.
Mm.
And I thought that that was really, really interesting and kind of funny, because if you look at history, you will find out that it is. That a lot of the same issues that we are facing now were faced by our foremothers and forefathers in the struggle. But there are also some things that are different. When we talk about organizing, we can do organizing in a different way, but there are a lot less avenues for organizing, for teaching organizing. And I don't mean organizing as community engagement, which is how it is taught now, but organizing that really speaks to acknowledging and changing the power dynamics. There's also a correlation with the way that we characterize those people who choose to resist. You see in popular media the way the character assassinations of people who were resisting, who were speaking out, the way that they were characterized as thugs. If their records were not squeaky clean, they really were taken to task. So there is a price to pay. And we as a country support the demonization of young people and others who get out and who really speak truth about what is happening in this country. And also there's a correlation between the way that we teach history. We talked about a racial battle fatigue of our parents and grandparents, but there also is a racial amnesia in our history books and in the way that we frame and characterize these movements. Even Selma, even when we talk about this celebration, there is an amnesia around the way that it is framed and promoted and celebrated. And we have to start telling truth about what has happened.
Okay, Dr. Combs.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to jump in there because as you were talking, and I totally agree with those comments, but I was resonating on the young man saying, you know, this is not your granddaddy's civil rights movement. And I was actually thinking something similar, although you're absolutely correct. There are certainly parallels. But part of the thing that made the nation and even the world respond in Selma and in other, well, particularly in Selma, because thousands thousands of people come out and heed Dr. King's call for those people of good conscience to come to Selma. But part of what makes it effective is what a New York Times television critic called their quiet humanity of the civil rights protesters. And so it was the fact that they dressed in a manner that that the larger society found to be acceptable. And I think that we need to free our young people today, and even Black America, we need to free our young people today, because we have an idea in our head that if their pants are down, they have nothing in their heads. And I think that, again, this isn't their granddaddy's civil rights movement. They don't look the same way that we presented ourselves, or many people presented themselves during that time. And I think we need to take some responsibility there as well, that young people have something to say, and it's time, just as we talk about in community development, that we should see the merit of the assets of the community, that they have something to say about solving their problems. And I think that we need to allow young people to have a voice irrespective of what they look like.
Well, I first of all, I want to thank Dr. Barbara Harris-Combs for taking the time out with us today. She's assistant professor of sociology and Southern studies at the University of Mississippi, and author of From Selma to Montgomery, The Long March to Freedom. It's really, your work is wonderful, and I look forward to having you back with us again.
Oh, I would love that.
Thank you so much. And Andrew Iden as well, co-author of this graphic memoir with Representative John Lewis about the Selma March. The second volume was just published. He's also a digital director and policy advisor to Representative John Lewis. And Andrew Iden, I also want to invite you back to spend some time with us and maybe the congressman as well, along with Nate Powell, talking about this series of graphic books, so our listeners can really get a feel for that. And I think it's a really important piece that the three of you have collaborated on.
Well, anytime. I appreciate it, and I'd love to.
I'd love to have that, too. Andrew, thank you so much, and take care of yourself.
Thank you. You too, sir.
Take care. So we're going to take a very brief break, and Adar will stay with us, and we will be joined by Brenton Mock from Color Lines as we come right back here. And we're going to break with the Drifters. There Goes My Baby, recording this day in 1959. Ah, the Drifters. I must be getting old. I do like that. Then and now. Reminding the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. Adar Ayira is with us still, and we're also joined by Brenton Mock, Washington, D.C.-based journalist who regularly writes for Grist about environmental justice issues and connections between environmental policy, race, and politics, and more. And Brenton, good to have you with us.
Great to be back on the show. Thanks.
Good to hear you. So, you know, there's one thing that struck me this morning. I was thinking about Selma, and I'm thinking about the historical context, but also where we are now. And one of those things was that shortly before Malcolm X was assassinated, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee asked him to come to Selma to speak, which he did at Bethel AME Church. And he gave this incredible speech to the audience. And people thought at first it was an anti-Martin speech, but it really was not an anti-Martin Luther King speech. Even though he talked about House and Field Negroes and set this up about talked about the cowards that you're going to confront. Be strong in the face of the cowards you're going to confront. Cowards because they fight in mobs to hurt people. And then later Mrs. King said in Eisner Prize 2 that meeting Malcolm X that day changed her mind about Malcolm X, changed her mind about what he stood for, and she realized that if they had both lived, that Malcolm and Martin would have been coming to the same place about what we have to do to change America. What are your thoughts on that, Brenton?
I mean, they obviously both were necessary, and historically, the kind of dichotomy between what is the best or most effective path to freedom for African Americans predates Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I mean, we can go all the way back to Du Bois and Martin Delaney, or Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, Martin Delaney, I mean, Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey, A. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King and Stokely Carmichael. I mean,
the
point being is that you know, there's, yeah, I mean, if they had King and X lived together, I mean, lived longer lives, had they, you know, whether they would have gotten on the same page or not is, you know, maybe they would have, maybe they wouldn't have. White supremacy would still exist either way. And the thing is we, you know, we need various ways of attacking it and addressing it. And, you know, I think what Malcolm X was, the value that he added to the discussion was one that said that, you know, African-Americans don't, you know, you shouldn't always have to compromise. I mean, one thing we know about Martin Luther King is that, I mean, he was about negotiating with the power, and he believed in compromise, and he pushed for that. And, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe that's the most effective way to go. But for some, in certain situations, you know, there is no compromise. You know, to quote Fela Kuti, you know, Fela Kuti. I mean, you know, sometimes you just, there's just no compromise, and I think all of those elements need to be represented.
Adar, you want to leap in on that? I'm sure you do.
I totally agree with what he said, and it reminds me again a comment that I made earlier, Mark, about how we frame things, how we frame resistance, how we frame history. And when we focus on one aspect of it, even in our focusing on Selma, we focus on the nonviolence, and we lift Martin Luther King Jr. and others up as nonviolent saints, and we still too often demonize Malcolm X and the work of Malcolm X. And in doing so, we completely erase the history of all of those involved in a resistance struggle who were for armed resistance in defense, not in offense, but in defense of homes, of property, of family, who didn't just sit and turn the other cheek. And we invalidate those aspects of the movement. So again, I go back to my point that we have to tell a whole full story and not just the part of the story that works better for our collective sense of comfort about what happened during this time.
You know, I mean, when you just said, Adar, and I like you both to comment on this, and just to push a little bit on that, I mean, one of the things that I think that we make this false dichotomy, I think, and I've made it about the civil rights movement, between violence and nonviolence, and between self-defense and nonviolence. You know, I was thinking about, I interviewed Charles Cobb about his book, The Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. And I also remember from my own life in the civil rights movement as a kid, that there was never a Freedom House you walked into where there weren't guns at the window.
Right. Yeah.
And so what I'm saying, there wasn't a split between violence and nonviolence. It was people, and I remember in Cambridge, Maryland, that the father of the now mayor of Cambridge, Maryland was Gloria Richardson's right hand, and every time he drove us from one voting registration piece to a demonstration to whatever we were doing, he always had a .45 and a sawed-off shotgun under his front seat.
Yes.
Well, right?
Mark,
that's what I'm saying.
Yes, but I'm not saying that there was a split within the movement. I'm saying that there is a split in the way that our history is taught.
That's true. Yes, there is a split there, a huge split. And Brendan Mock, we were talked earlier in this program about the battle over voting rights, and I said at the very top of the program today with the head of the NAACP, I said that, you know, you're going to sit on the dais with a man who is senator from Alabama, who is one of the people stopping voting rights from coming back to Congress, and yet these people are there celebrating Selma 50 years later.
And I'm sorry, who is this?
Who is who?
You went out for a minute, so I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I was talking at the top of the program to the new president of the NAACP. And they're all in Selma on this commemorative march. And some of the people on the commemorative march are people like the senator from Alabama, who is one of the leading forces in the Congress trying to not allow a bill about reforming voting rights to come up.
Right.
Those contradictions.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I mean, and it goes to show that I think for a lot of people in America, black and white, a lot of white people, a lot of white people in power, such as in Congress, I think for them, the civil rights movement is a museum, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just,
right.
It's not something real. It's not something living. It's not something ongoing. It's this thing that happened from, you know, arbitrarily from 1954, ended in 1968 with the passing of the Fair Housing Act. And we've moved on and we've made progress. And so, yeah, we can commemorate these events. We can take a few steps across this bridge, and I don't want to belittle the event. I lived in Montgomery, Alabama. I participated in that event long before it got popular. So, I know that I understand the significance of it, but when you put those kind of people in that context, they'll take a few steps across the bridge and sing "We Shall Overcome." Just a few weeks ago, Congress planted a tree in D.C. in memory of Emmett Till, which is problematic in so many ways. You know, a tree to many African Americans from the era of
right.
Emmett Till is a symbol
yes.
of a lynching.
Right.
Thank
you. You know, so but again, it's these kinds of these are gestures, right? And for them, it's proof that we respect civil rights. Whereas when you talk about lived experience and you talk about real equality, what really shows that you respect civil rights is that you will create policy that actually gives us civil rights, not a tree or taking some steps across a bridge.
Mm-hmm. Mark, ABC, Associated Black Charities, we have this pamphlet. It's called A Policy Application of a Racial Equity Lens. And it really is encouraging and giving concrete strategies and actions to our legislature in reference to doing that, to having that equity lens. And we have to continue to make those connections. For instance, in Maryland, talking about voting rights, we know that there are like 40,000 Maryland citizens who've lost voting rights because of convictions, because of criminal convictions. We know that a lot of them have convictions based on drugs, based on marijuana. Why are we not making the connection between all of these people who have lost voting rights, majority of them African American, to how this connects to our going for voting rights in the past and not having voting rights in the past? We don't make the pivot between what happened in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century and what's happening in the 20th and 21st century.
No,
we need to do that.
No, I think that's true. And Brenton, I think that some of the stuff you cover a great deal on environmental justice issues and more are also heart and soul as part of this.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean.
Go ahead, Brenton.
Yeah, I was going to say at the heart of all of it is justice. And whether we're talking environmental justice, criminal justice, housing justice, education justice, the point being is that African Americans, despite emancipation, despite the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, we have still not, as a race, been able to realize full citizenship, or we have not been realized as full citizens in America. And when you don't have full citizenship, let alone being seen as full humans, then you're seen as disposable. The places that you live are seen as sacrifice zones. The votes that you, in theory, have don't count. Or we're able to put up whatever kind of barrier we think will effectively make your vote not count. This doesn't happen if everyone is actually seen as full citizens participating in democracy. If you're seen as a nuisance to democracy or just some people who are getting in the way of democracy, then all of this stuff flies, right? You can create all kinds of policies, environmental, housing, education-wise, that truly makes life burdensome for these people, and this is what we've been dealing with in every century since we come to America, despite whatever progress that has been demonstrated.
Well, this is. I wish we had more time. This we'll do much more. And Brenton, I was just going to tell you, I've been looking at your tweets, and you just kind of spoke about some of the things you've been tweeting about, which I think is really important. And it's always great to have you with us, Brenton Mock. Let's hope you come back very, very, very soon.
Absolutely, anytime.
It's great to have you. And Adara here, my dear friend, always good to have you with us.
Listen, thank you so much for continuing to raise these topics, Mark.
I hope your tires get unstuck.
I hope so, for the rest of
years. Thank you all very much, and stay out of the roads if you can.
Yes.
We're going to take a very brief break here and come right back to our conversations as we look at what's happened with the Ferguson Report. And on our way to break, we're hearing Big Chief Blues by the great Furry Lewis. He was the first guitarist to play the bottleneck slide, born on this day in 1893. Furry Lewis.
I was 3 years old when my poor mother died. I was 3 years old when my poor mother died.